This message was recorded July 4, 2021. The speaker is David Simpson.
Now we take our Bibles and turn to the Gospel according to John. Find chapter 17, if you would, please. I want us to look. We've made it toward the last division in this 17th chapter, and we are moving toward the end of this chapter, and our verses today are in verse 22 and 23. It seems that all I do is carve out a little space, and I start thinking about what is here, and then it grows bigger. And so instead of me being able to take several verses, it ends up with one or two. So today, our verses will be verse 22 and 23 of chapter 17. Let's read them, please. It says, "And the glory which thou gavest me, I have given them, that they may be one, even as we are one." Now, verse 23, "I in them, and thou in me, that they may be made perfect in one, that the world may know that thou hast sent me, and hast loved them as thou hast loved me." Before we just look at the verses, I want you to put your eyeballs up on that little phrase in 23, "made perfect in one," made perfect in one. That word "perfect" is the word I've talked to you about through the years, teleo, same word that Jesus used when he said, "It is finished," teleo. And it's a word that means complete or completed. It's a perfect tense, which means a past completed act with a present and ongoing result. It is the voice of reality. So what Jesus is saying is that there is a reality in which you are made perfect, but also you're still going to be made perfect or complete. And then when he says "in one," he means together, in one, together. So he's talking about all of his people made perfect in one together. Now this completeness, what I just said may sound simple, but this completeness of the work of Christ on the cross is the dividing point and the watershed of truth. It really is, if you understand it. We declare that at the cross, then and there, the saving work of Jesus Christ was so complete that neither God's character, His holiness, nor His justice, nor His will could require any more. Jesus' saving work was so complete that it provided more than an opportunity to be made right with God, more than a ground on which He would make one right with God, but it is so complete that in connection with that work, and on the occasion of that work, meaning the cross, God actually saved His people. Jesus earned a perfect righteousness by fulfilling the law. When He fulfilled the law, the requirements of it in His life, bearing the penalties of it in His death, when He was finished, what God said was left was righteousness. And God took claim upon it, and therefore it is called God's righteousness, most definitely in the book of Romans, God's righteousness. Because Christ earned it, God gladly accepted it, took ownership of it, and furthermore, He reckoned that, transferred that righteousness, imputed that righteousness to the record and to the account of all that He had given to Christ. Now, we're not justified by faith, therefore. We're justified by that righteousness that God imputed. It redeemed from the curse of the law. It forgave the sins of those for whom Christ died. It justified them from all condemnation. It declared them right and righteous in the eyes of God. It assured and guaranteed to them a preservation in faith and a perseverance to the end. It guaranteed them a body, a glorified body in the end. And so when He talks about made perfect, made complete, there is a completion that has been made, and yet there is still more to come. And this completeness is inseparable from the glory of God. So how important is that? Well, it's so important that as we read this morning in that trilogy of Psalms, Psalm 22 is about the death of Christ. Psalm 23 is about the resurrection of Christ. And Psalm 24 is the ascension of Christ. And when He ascends into heaven, the angels begin to speak to one another. And they say, "Lift up your heads, O ye gates. Lift up, ye everlasting doors. And the King of glory shall come in." Another group of angels ask, "Who is this King of glory?" And the angels announce back to each other, "He is the Lord strong and mighty. He is the Lord mighty in battle. And He's mighty because He won the victory over sin and death and the devil. He won a victory that was so sure, so complete, that God received Him into heaven as the Lord of glory." The most eloquent preacher, that's not me, but the most eloquent of preachers, with his very best thoughts and his very best words, would still leave us wondering about the glory of God when we leave here. That's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. Because if God's glory were so small that a man could use words to describe that glory, it wouldn't be enough. That glory we will wonder about and explore through the whole of our life. We declare what Paul said to his protege Timothy when he referred to Jesus as the only potentate, the King of kings, the Lord of lords, who only has immortality and dwells in light. Now listen to this. "Which no man can approach unto, whom no man hath seen, nor can any man see." The best of our sight is to see only as if looking in an imperfect mirror. We can only see in part. And yet Jesus is talking about this glory here for those for whom He has made perfect or complete in His work. So now I want us to jump into these two verses and let's talk about what we find here. In verse number 22, look please in your Bible. Jesus said, "And the glory which Thou gavest Me." So it raises a question. What is this glory that Jesus is talking about? Well, if you'll look back in verse number 5, I'm going to tell you what it is not. I'm going to give you four things. There are five things that tell you what it is not. What is this glory that is not this glory? Well, first of all, it is not Jesus' eternal glory. I know that because in verse 5, He refers to, at the end of the verse, "the glory which I had with Thee before the world was." Before there was a star made. Before there was a moon. Before there was a solar system. Before there was an earth. Before there was the smallest of life in the whole of the universe. Before all of that. Our minds can only wonder at that. But there was a perfect glory in heaven between the Father and the Son and the Spirit. And this glory Jesus possessed as the eternal Son, as the co-equal with the Father. This glory is the sum of His attributes. And this glory Jesus never relinquished. This is not the glory. This is not the glory that we have. That is His eternal glory. Now I want you to look with me back to the book of Luke. So you're in John, go back to the book that is before that, and you'll find the gospel according to Luke. And we're going to look at three or four verses here. Look in Luke chapter 2. Luke chapter 2. The first thing I want you to see, not only is this not Jesus' eternal glory, this is not Jesus' incarnation glory. When Jesus was born, it tells us in Luke chapter 2, in verse number 8, "And there were in that same country shepherds abiding in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night. And lo, the angel of the Lord came upon them," and notice this, "and the glory of the Lord shone round about them, and they were sore afraid." This glory belongs only to Him. This glory is His in His incarnation. That only happened one time, that particular glory, that particular show of glory. There had been times in which there had been a Shekinah glory in the Old Testament. This is a unique glory, the glory of the Lord that shone all around them. This is not, in John 17, His incarnation glory. Now turn over to chapter 9 of Luke. I've said so far that this glory is not His eternal glory. I've said that it is not His incarnation glory. Now look what it says, what Jesus said in verse 26 of Luke 9. Luke 9. "For whomsoever shall be ashamed of me and my words, of him shall the Son of Man be ashamed, when he shall come in his own glory." So this glory is the glory that is his own. When he comes back to this earth, he came here, there was a glory. He went away, there was a glory. He will come back and there's a glory. This is still not that glory that he's talking about in John 17. Let me tell you another thing that it's not. Right down here in verse number 29, now here is the transfiguration. And it tells us, I'm still in Luke 9, now in verse 29, "And as he prayed, the fashion of his countenance was altered, and his raiment was white and glistering." He's describing a glory that hardly has words to describe it. So he says white and glistering. It's a way of saying that he sparkled in such a way that the eyes could hardly feast upon it. This is still not that glory. Not His eternal glory, His incarnation glory, His returning glory, His transfiguration glory. And one more thing, it is not Jesus' resurrection glory. Now look with me to chapter 24 of Luke. Chapter 24. Jesus has been to the cross. Jesus has resurrected from the grave. His disciples have assembled together, and look what it said in verse number 36. "And as they thus spoke," that's the disciples together, "Jesus himself stood in the midst of them." Here's my point. The glory that he had was so great, so unlimited, that no wall, no door could close up. If you went back and looked at this in John 20, you would see that the door had been closed, and makes a point of that so that no man could come, but Jesus simply stood in their midst. This still is not the glory that he's talking about. So what is this glory? Let me try to now tell you what it is. I've told you what it is not. Let me try to tell you what it is. Turn over a page. You're at the end of Luke. Turn over a page into John chapter 1. John chapter 1. What is this glory? Well, in verse number 1, it says, "In the beginning," it really is just beginning, "in beginning," means any beginning you want to talk about. "In beginning was the Word," that is a way of referring to Jesus Christ. "And the Word was with God," face to face with God, a way of referring to His equality. The first referred to His eternality. And then the Word was God, that's His essence. By His very definition, He is God. And then look what it says in verse 14, "And the Word was made," that is, He became what He was not. He was not flesh, He was eternal, eternally spirit in verse 1. In verse 14, He became flesh without giving up His eternality and His essence. The Word was made to be, He became flesh. "And He dwelt among us, and we beheld," what? "His glory." His glory. "And His glory was so great that it was the glory of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." So that when you saw Him, you studied Him, you were around Him, you understood Him. And now that we do that, what do we find? We find grace and truth. That's part of this glory that he's talking about. Now, I'll tell you a second thing that it is, but we won't turn and look at this. It is Jesus' earned glory. What do I mean by earned glory? Well, in Isaiah 53 and verse 12, it says, "Therefore I will divide with him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong." It's a way of saying that Jesus earned something by his death, by his obedience and his death, and what he earned was a perfect glory that none other could possibly have. No man ever did what he did. No man could ever do what he did. He earned a perfect glory. Here's a third thing that it is. It is Jesus' gospel glory. It's his revelation glory, his earned glory. It's his gospel glory. This gospel is glorious in its author and its content. It is glorious in its doctrines and decrees. It's glorious in its accomplishments and its applications. And it's glorious in its graciousness and its liberty. But it concerns one person, and that is Jesus Christ. When Paul concluded the explanation of the gospel from the beginning of Romans and going all the way through chapter 11, how did he conclude that? He said, "For of him and through him and to him are all things," meaning all things related to the gospel. "And to him be glory forever and ever. Amen." That's what he meant to say. Because that gospel concerns one thing. Not my decision, not my deeds, not my works. It concerns Jesus Christ and what God the Father did with that work. So to him be all glory. Not only is it Jesus' revelation glory, his earned glory, his gospel glory, it is Jesus' cross glory. Why do I say that? Paul said this at the end of Galatians. He said, "Some of you glory in your flesh." He said, "But God forbid that I should glory save in the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ." We think we understand the cross now. We don't. We know so little. But there's a day coming. There's a life coming in which our picture of the cross will be so crystal clear that what we know now will be as nothing. Why should we glory in anything save the cross of Jesus Christ? And I'll tell you one more thing, and this is the last thing. It is Jesus' earned glory, his gospel glory, his cross glory, but it's also his promised glory. And why do I say that? Well, it's because of what Jesus says right here in verse number 22, "And the glory which thou gavest me, I have given unto them, that they may," in the future, "be one as we are one." It's a promised glory. In Luke chapter 9, back in that passage we read a little earlier, part of it concerned Moses and Elijah, and they appeared in glory. That means in a glorious manner. And I think that that is telling us that one day that will be our state, our state. And this is the state of God's elect people in the world to come. So he says in our verse, so back to our verse now, "And the glory which you gave me," all that I've just said and more, "I have given unto them." I have given unto them. Now I want you to leave this and I want you to go to Romans. Can you do that? Turn a few pages to your right. You'll find the book of Romans, and I want you to go to chapter 8. Chapter 8. I'm just going to show you a couple of things, but they're important things. He says, "I've given unto them." First of all, he's given unto them because they, in verse number 17 of chapter 8, Romans, they are heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ. What Christ earned is also ours. We didn't earn it, but we are heirs with him. He earned a glory. That glory is ours. We're joint heirs. But then I want you to look down to verse number 28. And notice at the end of the verse, he refers to the called. The called. Anytime he uses that word, the little T-H-E, that means designation. So he is designating a certain and definite group of people. It's not haphazard. It's not whoever decides to be a part of the called. You can't be a part of the called and then not a part of the called. The called is based upon something. How did you become one of the called? He answers that. Look what he said. This is how you became one of the called. Verse number 29. For whom God did foreknow, he also did predestinate, that he might be conformed to the image of his Son, that he might be the firstborn among many brethren. But then he said, let me pick up with what I was just saying. Verse 30. Moreover, whom God did predestinate, of course, he predestinated because he foreknew them. And that just means that he didn't know what they would do. He foreknew them. He placed his knowledge upon them and he marked them off. And they're also called. That's how they became called. He knew them. He predestinated them and they became the called. He also then justified them, and whom he justified, and here's our last word, he also glorified. So the links in the chain would be that all God glorified, he justified, he called, he predestinated them, he foreknew them. And that five-link chain is unbreakable. You cannot take it apart. It is unbreakable. And that unbreakable chain gives us the security of what it is to be saved and be right before God. All of these verbs that he uses here, foreknowledge, predestinated, called, so forth, all of them are, in the Greek language, point action verbs. You don't have to really know what that means exactly, but it's a way of saying something is done. So he looks upon the whole of salvation with a panoramic view, and it's as if he had a wide-angle lens and he took a picture of it. And all of it in his mind, therefore, is complete. From God's foreknowledge to the final glorified state is completed. It's the way he looks at it. So that salvation cannot be broken up. For our poor minds, we take it apart and we look at it. So we look at what happened at the cross. We look at what happened in eternity. We look at what's going to happen because we can't hardly understand it any other way. But what he does is he looks at it as a whole. And he says, from God's foreknowledge all the way to that final glorified state, it is a completed act. Does that make sense to you? It is a completed act. He looks at it and he says that it is unbreakable, it is unbendable. Who is it for, this promised glory? Well, it's for those who are the joint heirs with Christ. It is for those who are the called. Now, come back to our text. And the glory which you gave to me, I have given to them. Now, as soon as you see the word that, are you back with me now? John 17:22. Are you with me? All right, see the word that always means in order that. In order that, so we wouldn't say that, wouldn't sound right. But in order that, they may be one, even as we are one. Now, I have talked about this oneness back in an earlier message a little more than a month ago, so I'm not going to try to go through talking about this oneness again. But this oneness has begun now, but this oneness will reach its completion in the next life. Some of you will remember that in Hebrews 12, he talks about you have come. He says, you have come. And he tells us what we've come to. And a part of what we've come to, he says, you've come to the church of the firstborn. Remember that? You've come to the church of the firstborn. And then he refers to them as their names written, meaning their names written before the foundation of the world, and it's his way of referring to God's election. You've come to the church, you've come to the place where the names are written down, and then he said, unto the perfection, so that the church altogether is looking for that perfection. And that perfection is exactly what Jesus is talking about right here. The penalty of the sin was taken away at the cross. The power of sin is overcome now in the course of our life. Doesn't much seem like it, does it? But we'd be a lot worse, if he weren't overcoming the power of sin in us. But then the presence of sin will be taken away in the next life. So there's more to come. And that's what Jesus is saying. And the glory which you gave to me, I have given to them. It's theirs. That they may be one. And then I hardly know how to speak of this. Even as we are one. Even as we are one. God's three in oneness is a perfect oneness. Yet perfect distinction. Do you get that? God's three in oneness. How can you read the Bible without seeing that God is Father and Son and Spirit? But also there is a perfect oneness, but a perfect distinctness, that they may be one as we are one. And then this in verse 23, I in them and thou in me. I can only put an exclamation mark and say, what unity. Jesus talked about it in John 15 when he talked about the vine. He said, I'm the vine, you're the branches. You have a perfect connection with me. I'm in you and you're in me. I don't completely understand that. It doesn't seem like he's in me, but he says he is. It doesn't seem like he's in us, but he says he is. I believe he is. He's in his people. He lives in his people. That they, so in order that, they may be made perfect in one. In order that, in looking to the next life. And in Ephesians 4 and 13, he says, till we all come in the unity of the faith. Isn't that what we're doing right now? We meet week after week because we're all coming in the unity of the faith. In that wonderful passage in Ephesians 5, where he talks about the comparison of marriage to Christ and his church, and he says that he might present her to himself, a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such or blemish or any such thing, that we should be holy and without blemish. Right now, it seems like we have all kinds of spots and blemishes. But one day, all those spots and blemishes are going to be gone. With this earthly tabernacle gives way to the heavenly one. We'll have a perfect oneness in body and mind and spirit, doctrine and love and knowledge and wisdom and fellowship and understanding, all of it will be summed up in one. I in them, thou in me, that they may be made perfect in one. Look again in the middle of verse 23. And that the world may know that thou hast sent me. This is not the created world. This is not the world of the unredeemed, the unchosen, the reprobate. This is the world of his elect. This is the world that was given to Christ. This is the world for whom he prayed and for whom he was about to die. That world. That they may know that thou hast sent me. That word know is the Greek word ginosko. And it means to know with a knowledge of experience. It may feel to some that we have a faith that is without feeling. That's not so. We have deep feeling. And that word know right there would speak to the experience that we may know, that we may know it in our experience. Then look at this. May know that thou hast sent me. So Jesus came on a mission. The Father sent him and the Spirit sent him. We've discovered before. And then look at this last phrase in verse 23. And that thou hast loved them. And I hardly know what to say about this. As thou hast loved me. Now think about it. The Father loves the Son with a perfect love. Because God can't do anything that is imperfect. It is eternal. He loves him as he loves no other. He loves him in a way that's indescribable. He loves us like he loves his Son. Could he love someone and let them go to hell? Now you know that's not right. There's nobody that he loved that's going to perish into a devil's hell. You love them as you love me. Would he let his Son go to hell? No. He let him suffer, but he didn't perish. He is not going to let one of his sons perish. The Father loves his elect as he loves his Son. We do not have the capacity to grasp the immense dimensions of God's love in this life, no matter how much we think about it. And I can tell you, the folks running around quoting John 3:16 and putting it on placards have no idea what they're talking about. They just don't know. It's sad. But we know that God's love is sufficient, so sufficient that the Father gave His Son and the Son gave His life. We know that it is so great that God declared His elect to be righteous when they have no righteousness of their own. We know that it is so great that He made them accepted, not acceptable, but accepted in the Beloved. What does that benefit us right now? Let me give you three quick things. It benefits us right now in order to see the freeness of His grace. He loved us not because of who we are, but because who He is. He loved us not because of what is inside of us. He loved us outside of ourselves. He placed His love upon His people. The freeness of His grace. We also see the perfection of His justice. Had God not designed a way to love His people in Christ, God would have been without honor and without glory. Now that's a thought, is it not? If God did not design a way to love us, and the one who became His satisfaction and our substitute, God would have been without honor and without glory, because love is far more than a decree. It's based upon the satisfaction of justice. We see the freeness of His grace and the perfection of His justice, and we also see the certainty of our hope. Romans 5 and 5 says, hope, biblical hope, makes not ashamed. It will never lead or leave you in going astray. It will never lead you or lead you in shame. It will never lead you to, and it will never leave you in disappointment. That's what he means. A little of what he means when he says, hope makes not ashamed. We're able to see the freeness of His grace. We're able to see the perfection of His justice. And we're able to see the certainty of His hope. Knowing that God loved us as He loved Christ, knowing that He loved us sufficiently to become our substitute, knowing that He stood in our place as the Lord, our righteousness, to fully justify us before God, therefore, we have hope, comfort, consolation, and spiritual rest.